is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, May 13th, 2024, and today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, back at the hotel after a Sunday night game between the Braves and the Mets. It was quite a thrill at the end. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios. How you doing, Taylor?
Buster, we're doing well on a glorious Mother's Day, the first Mother's Day for my wife with our daughter Lola. So I'm actually on the island right now, on Long Island. Podcasting on top of a dresser because everyone is asleep here. My father-in-law was like, oh, take the office, it's fine, but it goes right up against their bedroom, so like you always say, no one wants to hear the podcast voice when everyone's trying to sleep. So
you're kind of keeping it down a little bit.
Yeah, I'm like on the other side of the house, basically, in the spare bedroom. I didn't want to podcast in the bed because then I feel like I might get sleepy in there, so we're on a dresser.
All right, so how did you keep track, or did you keep track, as you went out to Long Island, did you keep track of Paul Skenes' first major league start?
I did. I mean, it's impossible if you're cruising on the internet. It's all anyone wanted to talk about. And, I mean, he delivers, touching 100. You know, it was a wacky game between the Pirates and the Cubs as well, so that, added a little bit of extra intrigue to it. But Skenes Day, everyone. And then, of course, everyone immediately comparing it to Steven Strasburg's debut, which we discussed. And I just hope that Paul's arm stays healthy and nice. Exactly. That's the only thing I can think about when I watch him pitch.
I know. He was throwing hard. Here was Skenes with his first major league strikeout.
Count full on Mike Tuchman. Here it is. Swing and a foul tip. He struck him out.
They hadn't thrown a fastball under 100 yet.
Yeah. That was funny. Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan. After the game, Paul Skenes talked about the awesome day.
It was awesome. Yeah, really cool. I mean, everybody talks about the stadium, and it's an awesome stadium, awesome skyline. Fans are awesome. It was just, you know, an awesome day.
He was asked if he had time to reflect on his debut.
I would say it was more warm up than during the game. I think I took a few like little moments, but once I got in the game, it was pretty much just about competing. But walking out to the bullpen and being in the bullpen, that kind of thing, took a little bit of time to reflect. But yeah, not too much other than that.
Hot Ticket is brought to you by Vivid Seats, the official ticketing partner of ESPN. Get great deals on the hottest tickets. Experience it live. And Paul Skenes' debut was obviously a hot ticket. Pretty good game also between the Mets and the Braves on Sunday Night Baseball. The Braves took a lead in the top of the second inning.
The 1-1. Swing and a ball drilled right field. This ball's back. This one's got a chance. And that one is gone. Keldick with a solo homer. And the Braves have jumped out to a 1-0 lead on a rocket by the former Met first rounder, Jared Keldick.
That was Boog Sciambi on ESPN Radio. David Cohn, of course, was at the game. Eduardo Perez is at the game. Carl Ravitch is part of our Sunday night booth. And we've got Eduardo and Coney on the clown car coming up to talk about what happened in this game, what happened in this series, and also what happened with Paul Skenes. It was 2-2, top of the eighth inning. Marcell Ozuna at the plate.
Tied at 1. We're in the 6th. The pitch. Swing and a ground ball up the middle. That'll get through for a base hit. Short racing around third. He's on his way to the plate. Olsen stops at second. It's an RBI single for Marcell Ozuna, and the Braves have taken a 2-1 lead.
Yeah, and for Marcell Ozuna, 40 RBI. He's the fastest Atlanta Brave player to 40 RBI since Henry Aaron. That's pretty good. Now, the Braves took that 3-2 lead into the bottom of the ninth inning, and Raisel Iglesias was not available because he pitched in a couple of games. So they brought in A.J. Minter. Runner got on base. Brandon Nimmo was at the plate. He didn't start this game because of some discomfort in his side when he took a swing on Saturday, but he came off the bench late, and this is what happened.
Minter is ready. Nimmo waits. 3-2 on the way. Swing and a ball drilled out towards center field. That one back. That one on its way. Gone! Nimmo has walked it off. Brandon Nimmo off A.J. Minter. And in the bottom of the ninth, the Mets win it 4-3.
Yeah, so Brandon Nimmo, he was so jacked up. Mets fans were jacked up. They salvaged the final game of a three-game series. Yankees face the Rays. Aaron Judge is heating up.
Judge hammers one to right field and deep and gone. Another home run for the Yankees, a two-run shot. And the Yankees lead 6-0.
That from the Yes Network, the Yankees win 10-6. Padres face the Dodgers. Padres had an excellent series, and you know what? Xander Bogaerts went deep.
Here's the 2-2. Xander swings, hits it in the air to deep left center field. Hernandez back to watch. It's going to go. There you go. Xander Bogaerts snaps an 0-for-17 with a long home run to left center field. And the Padres add on. It's 4-0.
Padres take another series, Taylor, from the Dodgers. How about that?
Buster, do the Dodgers have a Padres problem? Makes you think.
Man. And of course, Shohei Ohtani did not play in the last couple games because he had some back discomfort. The Dodgers are saying that's not a big deal. The Twins played the Blue Jays. It was 0-0, top of the seventh inning. Carlos Santana at the plate, two runners on base.
A 2-0 hit well. Right center field, Varsho chasing after it, looking up, and it's gone.
Yes.
A home run for the third consecutive game for Carlos Santana. He breaks the ice in a big-time way, and the Twins lead 3-0.
So it was a good weekend for the Twins against the Blue Jays. It was a terrible weekend for the Giants because they lost a couple of outfielders. Michael Conforto went to the injured list the day after he strained his right hamstring. And Jung-Hoo Lee, their center fielder they signed from Korea during the course of the winter, separated his left shoulder when he slammed into the center field wall at Oracle Park. So he's going to be out a while, you would assume. Terrible news for the Giants. The Mariners and the A's and Julio Rodriguez, who's had a slow start. Well, you know what? He went deep.
Dagger to lead, he goes. Pitch on the way, swinging a line shot. Deep center field. Blade going back to the winning track, to the wall. Goodbye, baseball! Julio Rodriguez, straight away center field. Julio with his second home run of the season. The crowd on their feet. Four runs are in here at the bottom of the second.
And you know, that made Sarah Lang smile. We'll be talking to her in a little bit. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, we're banging the drum here for the Low Post and the Hoop Collective. I'm loving the Hoop Collective's late night podcast. They're probably podcasting as we are right now. And then my fellow producers will also be up late stitching stuff together. So check those out. Hoop Collective, Low Post. You can watch it on YouTube or listen on this platform.
All right, we're about 10 minutes after the Braves and Mets have concluded. Brandon Nimmo with a walk-off home run. And as we always do after these Sunday night games, and we do in the clown car conversation, it's kind of takeaways from the weekend. Eduardo, what you got?
Wow, what do I have? I'll tell you this. I thought Chicago White Sox were going to win. We're going to win more than four in a row, but no, that did not happen. No, what I got out of this series, for example, is the Mets are competitive in this division. And you know, a lot of fans have asked about, are they going to be able to beat the Phillies, the Braves? They proved they can play with them, but they're going to need Lindor and the big boys and Pete Alonso. If those guys are not right, if the pitching isn't right, it's going to be tough. But, you know, you told us about the news of Kodai Senga, and I think that's going to play big on this in the National League East. But when you look at the West, I'm concerned for the Giants now. To me, the Dodgers are still the team above and beyond in that division. And in the Central, the Chicago Cubs continue to ball.
And the Braves come into the weekend having won, or come into the Sunday night game having won two-thirds of their games, and yet their big hitters haven't gotten going. Coney, what about you? What are some takeaways?
Yeah, the Braves are dangerous. They're not hitting on all cylinders as of yet. And we talked a lot about Marcell Ozuna having a great first half, first couple of months of the season, really going back to last year in a full calendar year, what his numbers are second to none. So, yes, it's amazing that he's carrying that team. They're going to come around. The Braves are dangerous. They're going to be there at the end. There's no two ways about it. The Phillies and the Braves are matching up to a great race. Maybe we're going to have a great pennant race down the stretch. And overall, the American League Central, to me, continues to be the shocker, really, with four teams at 500 or better, the Kansas City Royals, the Cleveland Guardians. And, you know, I have my eye overall on the American League Central.
So I wanted to ask you specifically about the two starting pitchers that we saw tonight. Luis Severino, who you knew well from his time with the Yankees, coming over the Mets, and Bryce Elder. Where do you see those two guys in their evolution?
Yeah, I think, you know, Bryce Elder showed the formula tonight on what he needs to do to be successful. And, you know, Buster, you pointed out the relationship he's developed with Greg Maddux is exactly the right thing he should be doing. You know, Greg Maddux owned both sides of the plate, especially glove side. Glove side sinker for a right-handed pitcher is hard, is the hardest pitch to throw, because you've really got to hang on to the ball and pinpoint it to keep it out there on the outside corner. Otherwise, it runs to the middle of the plate and becomes very hittable. And he got it going tonight, both sides of the plate with a sinker and a pretty good slider at times. And that's exactly what they need from him. 5-6 innings, 2-3 runs, keep your team in the game, and the Atlanta Braves are going to be just fine with that formula and him as well. And, you know, for me, on the other side, I think the Mets bullpen really kind of let them down tonight, you know, when you think about it. Even though they got the come-from-behind win, it just feels like if you've got a running game, even though they had a couple of pickoffs tonight, that's a problem for the Mets late in the game and the running game. And Mendoza knows it. He talked about it to us before the game. So, to me, that's a follow for the Mets. They've got to figure out how to stop the running game, especially when they're in with teams that can really run the bases.
Porto, specifically, when you look at the Braves' big three, Ronald Acuña Jr., Matt Olson, Austin Riley, and I guess we'll find out more on Monday about Austin Riley and whether this was a more serious injury or if they just took him out for precautionary reasons. Tell me what you're seeing in those guys.
You know, we got spoiled. That's the reality. We got spoiled last year with what those guys were able to do on a nightly basis. And especially early in the game, we always were like, okay, how many runs are they going to score early? They weren't missing. And it just seems like right now, you know, Ronald Acuña is chasing the phenomenal player that he was last year. And it's hard to do. And even Brian Snicker has said, you know, as media members ask what's wrong with those guys, it's you look at the unbelievable year that all of them had. Is it a matter of time until they start hitting? I believe it is, because Matt Olson right now looks a little bit better at the plate. You can see that he is staying in there with lefties. He's staying in there on breaking pitches also with righties. And with Riley, we'll wait and see what the news is with his midsection. But as far as I'm concerned, this is still a really good team. It's a team that has competed without those guys being the players that they were last year. And once they become that type of team, I think it's going to be good news for Atlanta. But as of now, you just have to hold your breath and continue to lean on the Marcell Ozunas and the Orlando Arcias that have been really good at the beginning of the season.
So the big national story of the weekend, of course, was about Paul Skenes and his debut for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Coney, I'll start with you. What was your takeaway from what you saw?
Just really impressive all the way around. I mean, we've heard such good stories about him, how well prepared he is, his background, military background, Air Force, what he did with his college years for his internships were just second to none from a character standpoint. So the expectations were really high, but his repertoire was just as good. I think it matched whatever we've heard about his background being so good, that his repertoire is much more polished than I've seen from a young pitcher in a long time. I think he's got obviously a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. He's got a splinker, like a hybrid grip changeup that he can throw to righties or lefties and have excellent command with. He has a slider or a sweeper that really breaks a lot and that he has good command with. So he's got a chance to have 3-plus pitches, well above average pitches, maybe even 4. And for any pitcher, anywhere, at any level, if you've got 2-plus pitches above average, then you're gonna be, you know, certainly at the top of the heap as far as production goes. So he's got a chance to be around a long time and be a really, really good one.
So in talking with a couple of evaluators who were at the game that he started, they talked about how in that particular start, his major league debut, that he threw a number of non-competitive pitches and also maybe his first taste of facing big league hitters in a major league game where they're kind of spitting on some of his stuff, Eduardo. Tell me what you saw.
Well, I'll tell you this. I sat at home and I watched from the first pitch and I saw the first two hitters go down and I'm going, okay, there's something here. I wanted to see how his fastball played. I was glad, for example, today that Mike Petriello came on our game and said, look, there's Christopher Morel has a really quick bat speed and he was able to catch up to that fastball. That actually was, for me, interesting news. But I thought at one point he leaned a lot on the off-speed stuff instead of establishing up in the zone. That's one thing he did not do. But that splinker that he throws that he developed this past year, I think it's a really interesting pitch to do so. But first outing, it's unfortunate some of the stuff, you know, with the rain and everything that really ruined it for the fans during that game. It was a really good offensive game for both teams. But Paul Skeens, I think, is going to be just fine. And he's going to dominate in this league. Just give him time. He'll be one of the best pitchers in baseball.
As you go around the big leagues, Eduardo, last one for you. A team you're very familiar with, the St. Louis Cardinals so far this season. What do you make of how they've started?
I just, you know, I talked to some evaluators about them, and I asked them the same thing. I said, what have you seen from St. Louis? Because what I'm seeing right now is a team that doesn't have a lot of energy, a team that just does not, it looks like they're waiting for the game to come to them instead of them being aggressive. And you know, they said the same exact thing. And that's to me, a little disappointing. The biggest takeaway that I've had is Paul Goldschmidt has not been the Paul Goldschmidt that we're used to seeing on a daily basis. We early on in this year, we were wondering if the power of Nolan Arenado was going to come. He's been better. He's gotten on base. Has the power been as consistent as the past? No, but he's giving you competitive at-bats. And this team, with as many young players as they have, they need those two veterans to lead. And now without Contreras, after breaking his forearm on the swing from J.D. Martinez, I think it's going to be very tough for them to be able to pick up that offense if Goldie is not the Goldie that we're used to seeing.
And, Coney, last one for you. You got a chance to see the Yankees and the Astros. What do you think of the Astros right now, and how? What do you think of the Yankees in terms of how they're responding to all the pressure that was on them going into spring training?
Yeah, the Yankees could not have asked for a better start, both to their season and to Juan Soto's season as well, as he's been really that big of a difference maker for the Yankees lineup. He's literally almost carried them when Stanton and Judge struggled in the first month of the season, and now everybody's kind of starting to come aboard now with him. But you know, there are certain hitters that you can put in a lineup that really do make that big of a difference. He's one of those guys. He's that talented, without a doubt. And the Yankees are going to be right there to the end, although the Orioles are great. And that's going to be another race, kind of like the Braves and the Phillies. You look at the O's and the Yankees, that's something to follow and to watch. Now, the Astros are not dead yet. I would not rule them out at all. When they get Christian Javier back, their rotation can kind of sort itself out. Their bullpen has really been, you know, a big mystery so far, but Hader still has great stuff. We saw him this weekend, and he was as good as ever in terms of his stuff overall. There hasn't been a big drop-off at all. So I expect the Astros to kind of hang in there, and because of their division, the Rangers aren't really running away from them as of yet. So there's still a chance for them to get back to 500 and be in a race. So I wouldn't give up on the Astros just yet, because I think their rotation's going to be fine, especially with Javier back and Blanco being excellent so far, and Verlander really pitching as well as he ever has, too, in my mind. So I'm not giving up on the Astros yet.
Well, and you mentioned the Orioles, Coney. Today I heard about a possible matchup that we could have in Sunday Night Baseball. I'm excited with the Orioles to be involved in that as we go through the summertime, because they are a dynamic team for sure. All right. Thank you to you both.
Kylie McDaniel covers baseball for ESPN. Kylie, how you doing on this late Sunday night?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I'm going to, as you know, most people know you for your coverage of prospects and projections on draft. And I'm going to ask you in just a moment about your top three in the draft. But you have an article coming up, which I'm sure is going to gain a lot of attention, get a lot of attention, about Scott Boras's winter. Which was the subject, as you know, of a lot of commentary within the industry with, you know, the likes of Matt Chapman and Blake Snell, Jordan Montgomery not getting the, you know, some of the sort of contract that were projected as the offseason began last fall to the degree that Jordan Montgomery has changed agents. So tell me what some of your big takeaways was from your reporting that you did on that.
So I had pitched it to my editors that it looked like it was worth diving into as these four guys were about to sign. And then as they were signing, they were like, oh yeah, this compared to what these guys were projected to get, and then what they got was a giant gap down. And then the other guys around them I projected all got a little bit more than I projected. And they were like, okay, so there's like an article here. So I started working on it, and putting some pieces together, talking to people, getting quotes, like trying to figure out, what fact and fiction and whatnot here. And then at that point, I ended up breaking the news that Jordan Montgomery is firing Boris. And that was, I don't know, like a month ago now. And I was just sort of finishing it up at that point. And that really gave me, because I realized when I was writing it, it's a lot of like, well, this guy said this, and then that guy said that. And this was below expectations, but were the expectations fair? It was a lot of hemming and hawing. And then Montgomery gives you the sort of hard information, like, oh, one of the four guys fired Boris, presumably because he didn't do as good a job as he wanted to do. Over the winter forum. And the sort of takeaway from all the sort of research and going through historical stuff and talking to people in the industry was that the league, and we've talked about this before, that the league has changed where it's hard to make a trade now because every team has the same process, the same algorithms, the same way of ranking players. And so this started at, sort of the outset of Moneyball. It really got going when Jeff Luhnow got to Houston and we get the ball tracking data. Everyone's using, spin rates and whatever. That's like almost 10 years ago. And basically got to the point now where like two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the team are kind of the teams are doing, making evaluations, making decisions the same way, coming to the same conclusions, approaching free agency the same way. The draft models are all the same. The international stuff's all the same. And if you then take a step back and look at what Scott Boras has been doing, he's been doing a version of the same thing the whole time. And at this whole process, he's been doing the same thing. He'll hold out late, he'll get a record-breaking deal, he'll, posture, get what he wants to get. Well, the teams are all slowly becoming the same thing, and he just keeps doing the same playbook. And then this year, all of that stuff just came crashing together. And it was like, does this playbook that Boras has been following, that he followed this offseason, and it didn't work? Is this going to work when all the teams are doing the same thing, which is not wanting to pay anybody $300 million? They want to stick to the process. They want to be efficient. Does his playbook and what most of the teams are doing, can those coexist anymore? Does one or the other have to take, or does he have to turn into something close to what the other agents are? That was, I thought, the interesting takeaway, that it's not just it was a bad offseason. It's does he have to change everything he's doing, or can he figure out a way to move forward and find the teams, the one team that wants to, match up with Pete Alonso, Juan Soto, the guys he has for this offseason? Can he make an adjustment and kind of get what he's looking for? And he just overshot one time and then he's going to fix it. That to me was the interesting part, is looking forward, because he has another great crop of players, especially if these guys that signed 1 year deal or, with opt-outs from last year, if they all hit the market again, then he has Burns, Bregman, Soto, Alonso on top of those potentially three more guys. That could be seven nine-figure guys. So it's like he's got another big opportunity. What's he going to do with it? That for me is the big question.
All right, so I'm gonna put you in a weird position. If you were hired as an advisor, a temporary, are you an evaluator of the winter? What would you tell Scott? What advice would you give to an agent who is so accomplished? Because what I was struck by, Kylie, over the wintertime was, you talk to agents and I talk to agents and you talk to teams and I talk to teams. And the gap between what I was hearing that Scott was aiming for with a particular player was so far away than what I was hearing from the teams when they were like, there's no way we're giving player X that kind of money. Like, what are we
Without having to
talking
report
about?
it was like he would be asking in some cases for $100 million more than what his best offer was, which seems unreal that that would be the gap between what he thought the player was worth and what the teams thought the player was worth, the teams that liked him the most.
Right. And in the past, as you say, that's worked for him. I think of an example, that being Chris Bryant. Like, I talked to teams, so many teams, when Chris Bryant became a free agent, said, hey, what do you think? And they were estimating $80 to $90 million. And then the Rockies jump in with this number that shocked everybody when they signed him. So based on what on what you learned doing this reporting, what would the adjustment be, you think, from Scott going forward?
So I think, for instance, Juan Soto, I think that's going to be an easy one, because the thing that the market still wants is the 25, 26, 27-year-old player, which
Right.
Soto will be, especially coming off of, what might be an MVP year. We saw Yamamoto got paid, Machado, Harper, all the guys that come up that are really good at that age, they all get paid. So that one, to me, is irrelevant to has Scott lost his touch or whatever. That guy's going to get $450 to $500 million. As everything goes the way you think it's going to go, any big agency could get that number. The question is, how is he going to do with the other guys if Chapman opts out, Bellinger opts out, Snell opts out? You then have Alonso as a right rate. I think he's going to be in his 30s. Burns, how much can you get any pitcher paid? Bregman, is he going to get 200? Those are the guys where you can measure if he's going to do a good job or not. I think the best thing going forward is, so the one big variable is there are a bunch of teams that have spent money with him, especially in the past, that were on the sidelines this offseason. San Diego, Washington, Boston, some of these teams that have historically been the big spenders that could bail him out weren't spending. That plus the RSN stuff is why you might say it's a one-off time thing as opposed to a concern going forward. What I would say is I don't think all of that stuff's going to correct itself. I think your best offer by Christmas is going to be your best offer. I think that's the adjustment he has to make, that is going to be the best way to get the most money. Just waiting into February, I don't think works with this crop of executives and the way they approach the game.
Okay. All right. Paul Skeens made his debut on Saturday. What was your takeaway from what you saw when he was a pre-draft and what you saw on Saturday?
There were certainly glimpses of the best version of him. He showed you all the pitches, all the stuff. If you were, you know, not super familiar with him watching him for the first time, like that's what it is. It's a lot of strikeouts. It's a lot of stuff. I noticed there were a couple times where the slider would catch a little too much of the middle of the plate and was... He was doing a good job staying to the bottom of the zone when he was missing. I noticed a couple times that there would be stuff that would have worked in college where, say, for instance, when he was, I think it was the first inning against Bellinger, he was going change up, and couldn't hit the location. And then he threw a fastball to finish him off and Bellinger fouled it off. And then he threw a slider in the dirt. And it was just like, oh, in college, like, I think all three of those would have worked. He didn't need it. And then Bellinger could lay off the, just off the plate and then foul one off. And so that's the little thing that it's not that he doesn't have the stuff to pull that off.
Yeah.
I don't think he's had to figure out how to execute at a high enough level to have to do that. And I also thought that he had a couple, I don't know, maybe six or seven more than I would have expected. The just sort of like looks amped up, yanks it right into the dirt where you're like, oh, that's probably first start jitters and trying to overthrow a little bit and finding himself a bit. So I think he did about what I would have expected him to do. And I'll be interested to see if two or three starts from now, he can have that level of command of the game that he had in college, where there's only two or three sort of completely uncompetitive pitches, and he has that put away feel that he knows, okay, this guy's gonna be able to foul this pitch off, but I can backdoor the slider. There's like, you know, you've got to be able to use each of your pitches two or three different ways, and I think he's still using them one or two ways. I think there's an extra gear he can go to, but I think he showed everything you're looking for, that he could be an ace as soon as like the end of the season.
Yeah, and you used a phrase that I heard from a couple of evaluators, the non-competitive pitches, that there were, you know, for them, a number of those in that game, and they attributed the same thing you did. You're just talking about jitters. And, you know, major league hitters maybe just given a different approach to than what he's used to in the past. And so we'll see, you know, how he adjusts as he moves forward. The Miami Marlins are going through a disastrous year. They kicked off their first trade, the trade season, by dealing Luis Arraez to the San Diego Padres. What's their plan going forward in your eyes?
I mean, this smells like one of those like hard reset rebuilds, like we're going to be bad for a little while and then hopefully at the end of that come out of it. I think the optimistic point of view would be, is this going to be a version of like what, say, David Stearns did in Milwaukee, where they never really bottomed out and were intentionally terrible for 3 years, like, say, Lunau in Houston was, or Elias in Boston was. So there's a version of this like power rebuild where you can make a couple smart trades, a couple smart free agent signings, maybe sign a couple young players to extensions, get a couple minor league deals, turn into real guys. You can kickstart this whole thing, but the gap between the amount of talent they need to be competitive in this division and what they have right now is really big. And you'll have Sandy Alcantara, you know, coming off of the IL, hopefully being the same guy. You got Dax Fulton coming off the IL, but like I'm looking at their farm system right now, the top three guys are all guys that were picked out of high school in last year's draft. So it's just like the capital in the farm system, which is bottom third right now, is also in like 18 and 19 year olds. And guys that they just got in this trade from San Diego, who I think are like good players, Dylan Head being the best of them. I think the second and third guys and the fourth guy are what we'd call roll four guys, like sort of set up middle relievers, platoon guys, like pretty good guys to have. And I think there's some pitching pieces in the big leagues. There's two or three, you know, hitter pieces in the big leagues, but it's like, you got to add nine more good players. I think this is like where Detroit was like 2 years ago, where they're just accumulating players. And I'd say now Detroit is at the point where they've accumulated enough players. It's just a matter of, are they a year away from that? Do they do the Milwaukee thing, or is this going to be a Baltimore? We're bad.
I was going to say that I mentioned last week, like I'm not advocating for a full on tankathon, but I kind of where they are and how close they are in the division, they would be a candidate for that. Yes.
Yeah. It's going to be, are they going to be really savvy, and are they also going to get lucky? They need both of those things to avoid the, like, we're going to be bad for 4 years move. Cause that would be the traditional sort of 10 years ago approach to this, is you got to shut the whole thing down and start over. But we've seen that, like, not every team has to do that. If you're good enough and lucky enough and time things just right, you can do this whole thing in like 2 years. But that's going to be one or two teams at a time can do anything like that.
All right. Who are the right now projected top three in your on your draft board?
So top three on my board, I think are probably consensus would be, first would be Charlie Condon, third baseman out of Georgia. Again, for people that aren't familiar with him, I'll throw comps at you. It's very similar to Chris Bryant, not quite as long and lean, not quite as athletic, but very similar. 6'5", probably a third baseman working on it. Huge power, 30 plus home run power, is having a bonkers year for Georgia. Also similar to Wyatt Langford in last year's draft, this guy redshirted his freshman year. This was not a big name, even like the middle of last year, he was becoming a big name. So he's also kind of come out of nowhere like Wyatt Langford. Could he go the same path? Who knows? Second would be Travis Bazzana, second baseman at Oregon State. He is super interesting. He is a 5'10", maybe, second baseman from Australia. Plus power, plus speed, also putting up bananas numbers at Oregon State right now. I think some teams prefer the sort of traditional safety of the big strapping Condon with big power. Bazzana's has almost the same level of in-game power and way less chase. He is even more polished than Condon is, but he's also a second baseman and doesn't have that like 70 grade tool that Condon will give you. So I think he's just a hair behind him. Some teams may have him ahead. I think most teams prefer Condon, as I do. And then I have basically a three-way tie at the next spot. I technically have Braden Montgomery, a right fielder at Texas A&M, listed next. If you wanted to go with Hagan Smith, the lefty out of Arkansas, or Jack Caglione, the first baseman out of Florida, all three of those are defensible. I have Montgomery just the slightest bit ahead of them because I think he has almost as much power as Caglione, and I think he's a slightly better hitter with slightly less chase and plays right field as opposed to first base. But those guys are essentially the same at this point.
Okay. And when are you going to think you'll how much do you think the board could move before we actually get to the draft?
So the sort of consensus, there's a big event, NHSI, it's a big high school tournament that there's like, I don't know, 200 scouts go there every year. Usually that is where we put together this consensus. And it seems that everyone kind of agrees that there are eight college players and two high school players, a top 10. That is the consensus. Almost every team's got 9 or 10 in that group. There's a little consensus of the one or two guys right behind that. So you might hear people call it 11 or 12, maybe as low as 8. But that 8 to 12 is like very solid. And the only way those guys aren't the like first 10 to 12 picks is if you're picking 10th and you like 10 guys and the guy you're left with is maybe not the one you're looking for at the right price, you'll dip outside of it. But I think chalk is going to be that those first 10 or 12 picks is going to be these 10 or 12 guys. And then it is complete mayhem after that. There is no consensus. Everyone's boards are completely scrambled. There's guys that I think should be 13th that teams don't have in the top 30. Like, it's all over the place.
All right. Well, I know Carl Ravitch, when you guys do the draft coverage, he loves mayhem. So just get ready for that. He just loves mayhem. Kylie, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm rooting for mayhem, but no names I've never heard of. That's the one part of mayhem I don't want.
On Saturday, before Luis Severino made his Sunday Night Baseball start, I got a chance to talk with the Mets right-hander. And man, it was a fascinating conversation about adjustments that he's made with his sinker, about how he finds comps and how he likes to Google pitchers and learn what their grips are, and how he's dealing with pitch tipping. Give a listen.
Fastball this year.
I went to dry line.
Okay.
And work on it. Last year, I thought velocity was good, but, you know, the little hop that I was seeing the years past, it was not there. So, you know, I went searching what it was, and I was losing some ride on it. So I went up there. They told me what I was doing wrong. I worked in the offseason, and so far it's working.
What were you? Did they tell you you were doing wrong?
I was just trying to overthrow a lot of fastball. Instead of going towards the catcher, I was moving my body more to like the first base side.
Yeah.
So I was pushing myself, and then I was by my
opening up.
Yeah,
a little
exactly.
Bit.
I was opening up, and then you told me if I fix that, you know, try to be more towards the catcher, my fastball is gonna maintain like that.
So how did you? I was saying on the call yesterday that you kind of remind me of a member of Valdi early in his career. Yeah. where the question was, could he get movement on what he had? And this year, you're getting a lot of movement on your fastball. How are you doing that?
I think just working on that little detail, you know. You know, mechanics is a really important part of the pitcher, starting pitcher. You can repeat the same mechanic every time. I think not all your pitches is going to be, you know, outstanding. You know, I also add a little two-seam in that's been working really good to right-handers.
Did you change your grip on that at all?
Yes, I did. Actually, I started working in the off-season, you know, just playing around to see what kind of pitch I can get, you know, ground balls, okay, double plays, trying to, you know, just get quickening.
How did you change your grip? I mean, what did you do that was different?
I mean, I'm a guy who likes to borrow pitches from other pitchers.
Who was your guy then?
I mean, I just looked in the Google, like, I was watching, like, a week ago, I was watching, like, Corbin Burns cutter, how he holds his cutter. So, you know, I grab it, I start playing catch, and I think it's moved good. Like, I would grab it, like, I also like it, I got a good sinker. Corbin Burns has a good sinker, too.
Yeah.
You know, I go in Google and say, oh, this is a good grip, it's moving, and then I try, like in the offseason, that's what I did. And I saw that pitch was moving really good, and I said, let me take it.
Who's sinker?
I don't remember it well, but I just Google all the best sinkers in the game. Like, you know, Corbin Burns is one of them. I remember talking to Gruber about it, too.
Yeah.
He also got a good sinker. You know, I Googled his sinker, too.
Yeah, he had tons of movement when he was at his best.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, just remember, like, going to, like, five or six guys to see what was the best pitch. I can't remember exactly what I took, but I'm glad that I took it.
Yeah, exactly. How different does the sinker look to you now that you kind of made this grip adjustment?
I mean, it's been fantastic.
Can you feel it?
Yeah, I can feel it. I can feel it moving. I can feel it, like, every time that I throw it, go to the same spot. You know, I'm trying to go middle in to righties, you know, to get that ground ball, even to lefty. You know, every time I throw, it's going to be, you know, if down on the way or down or up and away. So that's the pitch that I want.
So you'll aim it right over the middle?
Yeah, yeah. So I try to throw in the middle, and then it will move, you know, eventually. If I move, it's best. Pitch.
What's different about your grip compared to the one you had before?
The one before, my fingers were too close to each other, and then I started to split it up a little bit.
Okay.
And just because
on
of
the
that.
Seams?
Yeah.
Exactly. More on the seams
More
than
on
in
the
between
seams
the
than
seams?
In between, yeah, exactly.
Okay. And you could see it right away?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, I thought it was going to be like, if I split my finger, it's going to be slower. But, you know, I started throwing it, and it was the same velocity. So I was like, this, like in the offseason, like this is going to move like that with, you know, 95, 96. It's going to be a great pitch.
So how did you, as you're doing that, the whole question of tipping pitches, how did you deal with that?
I mean, just in the offseason, I talked to a lot of guys like Carlos Beltran, Rossi.
Ask him what they saw?
Coach. Yeah, of course, because I faced Carlos a lot, and then when I came to the big leagues, he worked with the Yankees at that time, and he helped me a lot. You know, he told me about what I was doing wrong. Every outing, I was doing something wrong.
What so, sort of thing?
I mean, even like I was with the breaking pitches, I was separating earlier than the fastball, or I was seeing myself like slowing my arm speed, and every time like Carlos told me, like, Sebi, you need to work on this. Next outing, I fixed that one, there's another one, and I mean, it made me grow up as a pitcher, and made me realize that I had to, you know, to be in the game, to be good in the game, I need to make a lot of adjustments. So I talked to him, he went down to spin training.
This year?
Yeah.
And did he stand behind home plate?
He was in the bullpen. He was behind me seeing pitches.
No kidding.
And, you know, even we saw some videos, and he told me, like, I said, right now, you look good. You know, I don't see nothing. Even right now, we have some guys, you know, who just focus and die. Every outing, I go there, and he asked me, like, you guys see something? I said, no, you're good right now, so keep doing your thing. So I'm glad that, you know, fixed that issue in the offseason. No pitcher is perfect. I got some.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes I will go back to that habit, but, you know, I got some people here that are aware of what I do, and they will make me, you know, right away.
what's the camera angle they look at when they look at video? Is it behind home plate?
It just depends. Like last year, like with man second, I was setting up, looping at second, then stopping at third, and throwing fastball, and then looping at second, and going straight to home plate. It was off speed. It was not 100% of the time, but wow. It was like, if I got a big situation, you know, and they see that, I say, oh, maybe 80% of the time, if he do it, it's going to be awesome.
Wow.
So that was, it was a quick adjustment, but I didn't know until like late in the season. So I work on that. There's other things, like, you know, with breaking pitches, I was setting up here, and then like I was doing this with breaking pitches instead of pass. I was doing, I was
lean back. Break.
So also that I got work just to, you know, be in the same, and then at the end, you know, let's throw. It's gonna be a pass. It's gonna be in the end, and then all the change and stuff be at the end.
Beltran's great to talk to. You know, yeah. Eduardo Perez.
Yeah.
He's really good at that.
Yeah.
He'll see things right away. Like he'll be watching a guy. Said, "I got it."
Yeah, of course. I mean, those are the guys that you have to, you know, have on your side, you know, to talk with and see what they can see from you so you can fix it right away.
So Carlos will still watch video for you? You might send it to him?
I haven't talked to him since the start of the season, but as of right now, everything is good. But
yeah.
If I see something, like if something's going on, I would definitely reach to him. And we have a lot of good guys, like Jeremy Hedner is really good, and, you know, our bullpen coach, Rosado, he's really good too. So relying on those guys, I think they're going to help me a lot.
Why the Mets? Because I'm guessing you had a lot of opportunities on a short-term contract.
I just love New York.
Yeah.
I love the fans, and I love to be here. And also, you know, having Mandy, a face that I know for a long time, and then the training staff is just unbelievable. You know, I've been working with Joe Golia since I got here, so it's been training, and we've been working the same amount of time since the first day. You know, he really takes time with me to make it better. Also in the gym, you know, with Dustin. So I think everybody, they're just the best. You know, and that was my first issue. You know, going to a new team and not knowing how the trainers is gonna be. You know, how I can maintain myself healthy for a full year, and then coming here, it was a great decision for me.
You were nodding your head when I said Eovaldi, you know, in terms of his change over the course of his career, because I could see you doing the same thing. You know what I mean? As time goes on, you get better and better and better with adjustments.
Yeah, I mean, I played with Eovaldi,
and
I saw like the struggle he had early, and you know, for him, I'm really happy because he's the hardest worker I ever hit seen in my life. Like, he's just a great guy to compete. And, you know, he's the guy, like, if you look at it, and this is the guy that I want to be, because he just, everything is, like, you know, in the line. So even, like, he eats well, you know, he go sleep early, he doesn't go out. Like, he's just a great guy, and I'm really happy for him.
Sebi, it's great catching up.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see you pitch tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
0096. This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. We're talking to her right after she got done doing fine work on Sunday Night Baseball. Sarah, what are you doing?
I'm doing well. What am I doing? I'm eating dinner as I always am. When we chat on Sunday night, obviously, I pause to talk to you. But eating dinner, I got the crossword up, got to finish the Sunday, and watching the end of the basketball and the postgame show there.
Man, so you got a ways to go. Like, I am ready to go to bed. I must say, like, I am ready to go to sleep at the end. I got a 6 a.m. flight to, you know, through Minneapolis, going back to Montana, and you're going to be up all night. You know, you night owls. I just don't understand. All right. So Mike Petriello, who's one of your colleagues at MLB.com, you know, was on Sunday Night Baseball, and he talked about this new ream of data that is being released about swings, about swing path, and about swing speed. Just tell me something about that.
Absolutely. So Mike did a great job. I was so glad it worked out. He was able to come in the booth and talk for an inning about this. So as of Monday morning, May 13th, Zach Hess is introducing our new bat speed metrics. So these are only from the 2024 season, but they give us information we've never had before. We can now tell you how fast an individual swing was on a home run, on any play, and we can tell you an average mouse swing speed for a player and their bat speed. We also have additional stats that kind of come out of this. So in the same way that when I talk to you about exit velocity, we focus on 95 plus hard hit. With swings, a fast swing is kind of your version of hard hit there. And that's a 75 plus mile an hour swing. And the reason we care about that, you have a 310 average and a 609 slugging on average so far this season when you swing the bat fast. A couple other things we look at are the idea of squaring up a ball. So this is a term that we've been hearing, I mean, since baseball has existed. We'd love to know the origin of it. Well, what it means in a stat caster is essentially optimizing the amount of exit velocity you can get from a swing. So not scale physics on you, because I don't even know all the numbers. When the idea is based on how fast you swing and how fast the pitch is coming in, there is a maximum amount of exit velocity that you can generate. So squaring up a ball means that you got at least a certain percentage of that potential exit velocity. So the idea that we hear all the time of, oh, he just missed that one, we can kind of look at it and define what that is. And then one other term, and then we can get to the first game, is a blast. So a blast is when you square off the ball and you have a fast swing. Squaring off the ball does not have a minimum swing speed. Anyone can square up the ball. It's just maximizing what was possible. A blast is when you do that and you swing really hard. So, I mean, the term is kind of self-explanatory, but it's really cool to be able to quantify that.
Yeah, I've seen I was driving back from the ballpark after the game, I saw Derek Gould, for example, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, talking about how he was exciting, sort of digging into the reams of data that are generated by this. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is 80.6. So the first question I think anyone should have after all that I just said is, okay, who swings the fastest in baseball so far this year? And I think it should surprise very few people to hear that the answer is none other than Giancarlo Stanton at 80.6 miles an hour of average bat speed. So for context, the major league average is 72. So he's there, 8 miles an hour faster than that on average. And in second is O'Neill Cruz at 77.7 miles an hour. And these numbers were entering Sunday, and it may have gone up with what he did on Sunday anyway. And then, with exit velocity, we talk about the idea of not just what is your average exit velocity, but how often do you hit the ball hard. So we look at it that way. Obviously, since the lead, he swings fast again, 75 plus miles an hour, 98.4% of the time. Doesn't even sound real. And then second, we have Kyle Schwarber at 73.9. That's looking at, okay, we don't really care how fast the swing was once you reach a certain threshold. Did you reach that threshold? And one other with this number I want to say is Luis Arraez. Luis Arraez has long been the guy who people think Zach Hess maybe doesn't like him. That is not the case, but he is very unique. So he has a 62.3 on our average bat speed. That is the lowest in baseball.
Wow.
But his squared up rate, so I told you earlier, that is how much you optimize the speed of your swing and the speed of the pitch coming towards you, is 43.9%, which is the highest. So he doesn't swing very hard, but he makes the most of every swing.
Yeah, I bet Tony Gwynn would have been great at that number.
Number two.
Number two is 40.3%. So that's Juan Soto's squared up rate. That's the percentage of his swings that are squared up. That's in the top four in baseball. What makes him unique, and you know, no one know, just hearing the idea of best main metrics, that Juan Soto would be an outlier on these in a really good way. So he has that 40% squared up rate. He also has a 76.1 mile an hour average bat speed. That is the highest squared up rate for anyone with at least an average bat speed. And again, he's 4 miles an hour above average. So he is squaring up the ball and hitting it hard more than anyone in baseball, which again, fits the eye test perfectly.
Number one.
Number one is 25.1. So I mentioned blasts at the beginning. Those matter balls, which are both squared up, and those swings, I should say, they're both squared up and come on a fast swing. William Contreras leads the major with 25.1% of his swings being blasts. I think anyone who has watched him this year and seen the power he has had would absolutely agree with that ranking and understand where that's coming from. And to the point with Soto, before he is second on that list, Shohei Ohtani is third, and then Giancarlo Stanton. I just want to encourage anyone who is interested in this, it's all on Baseball Savant as of Monday, and it's very, very interesting to go through the leaderboard and see who is optimizing their swing and how, and there's so much more you didn't even get to. I wanted to give people a taste of it.
Sarah, before you go, give me your impressions of Paul Skenes from watching him on Saturday, because I'm guessing you kind of built your day around seeing his game.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, that was so much fun. I mean, his first inning in the majors, he threw the fastest pitch any Pirates starter has thrown in the pitch tracking era. And his first strikeout, tied for the fastest strikeout by any Pirates starter in that span. And then an inning or two later, he broke his own tie for a record. It was so much fun to watch, so electric. And what a wild game with that fifth inning, the way it played out after he was removed. These six pieces of walks with a rain delay in between. They were one of just three teams since at least 1957. Now, six bases load walks issued in any game. And two of those teams that issued those bases load walks ended up winning the game, which is why baseball is amazing.
That's crazy. That's unbelievable. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this. Enjoy your dinner. And, you know, you probably, you know, got to watch a movie, read a book before you ever get to bed.
Thank you, Buster. Thanks for having me.
Bleacher Tweets. Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Monday. You can call the Bleacher Tweets voicemail line at 406-404-8460. You can email the show bleachertweets@gmail.com, or you can reach out on Twitter, hashtag Bleacher Tweets. Let's go to the voicemails.
Hi, Buster. My name is Henry Simpson, and I live in Trophy Club, Texas. Do you think that Jerickson Profar could be an MVP candidate? He has been crushing the ball as of late. Thank you, Buster. Go Padres.
All right. I love that question. He is definitely having a renaissance year. I kind of wonder if Jerickson Profar is one of those guys, because he didn't have a good year with the Rockies last year, if he's better when he's with a team that's kind of in the mix. You know, maybe he just like playing with the Padres more. I think right now Mookie Betts would be the heavy favorite to be the National League MVP if he stays healthy. But Jerickson Profar has been an absolute revelation for the Padres this year, no question.
Hey, guys, it's John from Framingham, Massachusetts. do you think people have overvalued what the Blue Jays offense could be because of the year or year plus they spent in a minor league ballpark back in 2020?
Huh. That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that. I think it's more of thinking that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was going to be, you know, what he was younger in his career, that you just assume as he got older and he gained experience that he was just going to keep getting better and better and better. Instead, you know, as Hembo has described in his appearances the last couple of weeks, he's had issues in the lower half of the strike zone. And I also thought, you know, probably because of Bo Bichette having a good season last year, you thought that he would have another one good this year. I mean, clearly the Blue Jays gambled that they could bring back the same cast of characters, basically, and it would get better. But, you know, I mean, for one reason or another, it just has not come close to being what everyone anticipated was going to be 3 years ago. That's for sure.
Lost another series this weekend to the Twins. Tough yep. break. Let's read a couple emails here. David from the UK. This is a good one. He writes in, first time emailer, but long time listener to the podcast. And to my joy, first time visitor to New York on Sunday evening. I'll be at Citi Field for my first U.S. baseball match. Yeah, when the Mets play the Braves, I've had the privilege of watching London games, but have grown up learning the game from you, Buster. And it's going to be cool to know that you'll be reporting on my first U.S. game. Thanks for imparting your baseball knowledge to a naive and remote Englishman. And here's hoping for a great game. And he sent in a great selfie from a bar before he went to the game. I'll forward it along to you, Buster. But David was treated to a good one tonight. I'm very happy for him.
Yeah, it was a great game. And by the way, you know who else was there? It was my son, Jake.
Oh!
Came in with some friends from Hofstra, and he had an absolute blast right up to the moment that his Braves lost to Brandon Nimmo on that walk-off two-run home run. But he had a great time walking around in his Matt Olson jersey.
Oh, nice. I love that.
Yeah.
Brecken Carbonato, maybe not the best time for this because Julio Rodriguez did hit a home run today, but Brecken wants to know, why does he start every season terribly? What's up with that? Do you have hopes for him to improve, Buster? He's got.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's funny, though. I coincidentally had a conversation yesterday with Austin Riley of the Braves, and he was like, yeah, I start slowly, and I don't know why. I mean, you know, there are players where that happens. I think Bryce Harper had that early in his career. No, it wasn't Bryce. It was somebody else. But anyway, it happens. There are just some players that just go through that rhythm. You know, what Austin theorized was that it just takes time for him to sort of get into the rhythm of the season, get into a role. Maybe that's what's going on with Julio.
That makes sense. Mariners are playing well, though. Got to be pleased with that. Our guy, Dave Schoenfield. Martha Wales writes in, greetings from Montpelier, Vermont. I didn't know there was
Montpelier.
Montpelier. Oh, man. Schooled me there. Didn't know there was an official cow out day, but long ago we went to a cow out party, just like you said. The cows frolicked and kicked up their heels with joy. Such a great memory. Another Bleacher tweeter sent me a video of that. Coach Sorensen called in and said he just put his cows out to pasture. Martha also notes that she's from Minnesota. She's a Twins fan and loved the Ryan Jeffers interview. But lots of people, the cow out day really resonated with our listeners.
Nice.
We love that.
I love that. That makes me happy. I want to see that video of the cows because they do. They frolic. They have fun.
It's so funny. Let's go to Matt, collector of bobbleheads, Kayaking Smith. He sent in a picture in a couple days ago. Got to meet, hang out, and hear stories from longtime Oriole Melvin Mora tonight. Super awesome person. Really enjoyed spending time with him. One of the few good Orioles from those really dark early 2000 days. Did you ever meet Melvin Mora back in the day?
Oh, yeah. Talked to him. Oh, yeah. No question. He was a young player in the Mets organization when I covered them.
Nice. PK Steinberg writes in, what do you think Ranger Suarez's in-game heart rate is? 39-45. Has there ever been such an unfazed, calm-looking pitcher?
Yeah, David Wells. He reminds me a lot of David Wells, another left-hander who it just felt like in the postseason, he was so under control. And he just, you know, I've had this conversation about Ranger with other people and made that comparison to David Wells, that I just think that some guys, he just seems so at ease. And Ranger is part of the reason why I think the Phillies are really dangerous.
Mm. Let's go to here for Bleacher Tweets and FRL. This is Travis. He writes, can you explain win tiers? For example, if a team generally wins 87 games in a year, in my mind, that's good, but not a great team. But if a team wins 84, that's an average team. What are your numbers and tiers for wins?
Boy, I think of 90 wins. Like if you're north of 90 wins and you're a pretty good team, if you win 100 games, you're one of the elite teams. Like I think the Dodgers, Phillies, and Braves will all win 100 games. The Orioles in the National League, the Orioles and the Yankees, I think have a chance in the American League. Those are potentially great teams. Then you go 90. And then it is kind of like 84 would be another tier. Because I think if you go 84 north, it means you're going to be a contender. Mm-hmm. Pretty hard to be a contender, though, when you're, you know, you're basically a 500 team and below.
Yeah. All right, that's it for the Bleacher Tweets. You can find the number, the email address, the hashtag all in the show notes. Shout out to Seguida, Bonnie, Beckett Hutchinson, Coach Sorensen again, and Rod Foster, who's offered to take us fishing. He said, Buster, but I will take you fishing. Taylor, we can go on a booze cruise in Missoula, Montana, if we ever make it up there. So thanks. Appreciate it, Rod. Thanks for writing in, calling in, everyone.
All right. That's it for today. That's it for tonight. My thanks to Kylie McDaniel, to David Cohn, to Eduardo Perez, to Sarah Langs, to Luis Severino, and to Taylor, who's up late on a Sunday night as Lola sleeps. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.